Welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Tonight we bring you an excerpt from the annual Boston-Melbourne-Oxford Conversazione on Culture and Society, held last fall at Boston University. The theme was Responsibility and Historical Inevitability. Participants include the university professors, members from La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia, and Lincoln College, Oxford, among others. Tonight's presenter is author, British political philosopher, and constitutional commentator Ferdinand Mount, currently editor of the literary supplement of the London Times. Mr. Mount is former head of Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher's policy unit. Reacting to Mr. Mount's assertions is university professor Lance Morrow, professor of journalism at Boston University. Here now is Ferdinand Mount on When Two or More Are Gathered Together, Small Groups and Great Movements.
It's a delight to be in Boston for the Conversazione and to see so many TLS contributors and readers here in our centenary year. Now, I'm hard pounding over the battlefield, the snipers of the individualists are certainly outnumbering the massed forces of the vast impersonal forces of destiny. There was a sort of rally when Colonel Velez appeared to help them out, but I suspected he was a double agent, and I don't think he can be seriously counted as a... But anyway, there was some interesting reinforcement for the determinist position. What I'm going to try and do is to crawl across no man's land, in no doubt a rather rambling course, to look at the intermediate ground, if you like, between the idea of vast impersonal forces and on the one hand and the individual on the other, and look at the role of small groups and the individuals who compose them in provoking change of all sorts, intellectual, artistic, political, and so on. I'm going to start by talking about the birth of the, or supposed birth of the Romantic movement in England. On September the 20th, 1800, Wordsworth sent his publishers a first draft of his famous preface to the second edition of Lyrical Ballads, the preface in which he was to set out his ideas about poetry in words so memorable and far-reaching that they have probably influenced every poet who's written in the English language since then, whether they're fully aware of it or not, or whether or not they happen to revere Wordsworth's own poetry. Ideas about the use of ordinary language, the suitability of humble everyday subjects, ideas about emotion recollected in tranquility, about the importance of truth and sincerity, and in particular the importance of the experiencing suffering self. The draft included in its opening page the following paragraph. Wordsworth wrote, "For the sake of variety and from a consciousness of my own weakness, I have again requested the assistance of a friend who contributed largely to the first volume and who has now furnished me with the long and beautiful poem of Christabel, without which I should not yet have ventured to present a second volume to the public. I should not, however, have requested his assistance had I not believed that the poems of my friend," that's Coleridge, "would in a great measure have the same tendency as my own, and that though there would be found a difference, there would be found no discordance in the colours of our style, as our opinions on the subject of poetry do almost coincide. It would be hard to imagine a more delicate and thoughtful record of collaboration between two great poets. The British critic David Hurd, in his perceptive study, John Ashbery and American Poetry, quotes this passage to illustrate the kind of relationship Ashbery enjoyed with his fellow poets Frank O'Hara and Kenneth Koch in New York in the 1950s. Like the Lake poets, they hung around together, they read the same books, exchanged ideas about writing, problems, gossip. It is out of such intense circles of friendship, we are told, that arise great new movements, whether in the arts and sciences or politics and philosophy. Yet only a matter of weeks after Wordsworth sent off that immortal draft, he began to have second thoughts about the passage I have read to you, indeed about the new edition as a whole, and in particular about his poetic connection with Coleridge. First, Christabel was now to be excluded. It was too long. It was unfinished. Its style of medieval balladry was discordant in its character with Wordsworth's own poetry of rural life. But wasn't The Ancient Mariner similarly discordant? Well, Wordsworth was now having second thoughts about The Ancient Mariner, too. In one of the most extraordinary actions in the history of literary collaboration, he attached a note to The Ancient Mariner, a note which Coleridge did not even see before it appeared in print. And this is what the note said. The author was himself very desirous that The Ancient Mariner should be suppressed. This wish had arisen from a consciousness of the defects of the poem and from a knowledge that many persons had been much displeased with it. The poem of my friend has indeed great defects. First, that the principal person has no distinct character, either in his profession of mariner or as a human being, who, having been long under the control of supernatural impressions, might be supposed himself to partake of something supernatural. Secondly, he does not act, but is continually acted upon. Thirdly, the events, having no necessary connection, don't produce each other. And lastly, the imagery is somewhat too laboriously accumulated. Now, some of these defects we would list today as among the poem's marvellous qualities. We might, in fact, think that Wordsworth had not quite got the poem. At any rate, he wasn't finished yet. It was already agreed that the new edition of Lyrical Ballads was not to appear anonymously, like the first edition, but under the sole name of William Wordsworth. And then Wordsworth set about removing any record of the collaboration by erasing the entire paragraph I first read, and by the time you reach the final 1850 edition of Lyrical Ballads shortly before his death, all mention of Samuel Taylor Coleridge has vanished. If Wordsworth had enjoyed then and now less of a reputation for personal integrity and purity, his behaviour would have been regarded as a ripe example of self-seeking deviousness and treachery, the sort of thing we might expect from a member of the Supreme Soviet. The curious thing is that in the mind of posterity, in our minds, the collaboration survives unscathed. For us, the authors of Lyrical Ballads continue to be Wordsworth and Coleridge. Their varied styles continue to contribute to the multitudinous, multifarious rills, streams and torrents of English verse, as do their varied critical approaches. Some modern critics treat Coleridge as the real moving spirit behind the Romantic movement, the man who taught us and teaches us still today the virtues of the ambiguous, the uncertain, the amorphous, the unclosed, the father of the modern movement in literature and the grandfather of postmodernism. Other critics, not all of them fanatical Wordsworthians, are still attempting to airbrush Coleridge out of the big picture, pointing out how few poems he contributed to Lyrical Ballads, how few really great poems he ever wrote, and how much of his later, supposedly profound philosophizing is in fact straight cribbing from Schelling and other great German thinkers of the day. For Norman Fruman, as for Charles Lamb, Coleridge is a damaged archangel. For Richard Holmes, on the other hand, Coleridge isn't really damaged at all. Yet, whichever side you take or don't take, what is clear that this collaboration, which ended in such a mess and a complete disagreement about the purpose and nature of poetry, has endured to bring about a new way of being a poet, perhaps even a new way of being a person, what Keats so acutely dubbed the Wordsworthian or egotistical sublime. Earlier we heard, it's always so hard to envisage exactly how they did it. Moneypenny and Buckle, the Goncourt brothers. Being brothers doesn't seem to make it any easier to establish who wrote what, how much help did they give each other, who took the lead. It's an untidy-sounding phenomenon. And so, as with all untidy prospects, the natural human instinct is to tidy it up, to give the thing a precise, satisfying shape. We are keen to prove that it was really all A's work, B being merely a sympathetic drudge, or vice versa. It's a better story still if we can bring into the limelight of posterity an unsung hero who has been elbowed out of the attention all these years by an overrating, posturing inferior. For a satisfactory feminist perspective, it's better still if the unsung one is a heroine. The attempt, for example, to show that John Stuart Mill's finest thoughts are really the work of Harriet Taylor. Less often efforts are made in the other direction to prove that Frankenstein was really knocked off by Percy Bysshe Shelley on a wet afternoon, leaving it to Mary to apply the finishing touches. But anyway, inquiries of this sort blend all their best efforts, and frequently bend the evidence too, towards demonstrating that a single person, whether the person first thought of or another, was the prime mover, the one to whom we really owe the victory or the theory or the masterpiece. But there is, of course, another school. Radically and permanently opposed to the hero worshippers stand the groupers, those who regard all human achievements as essentially collective endeavours derived from impersonal forces and shared traditions, driven on by the zeitgeist, translated into isms, and carried out by groups, parties, and tendencies. Writers of this school may compose a whole book scarcely mentioning a single individual by name, unless with an ism tacked on to that name, so that every single action or work or art of, or scholarship, including that of the person who may be named, appears not to spring out of a single human head, but out of the spirit of the times. There is, of course, a pleasing ricochet effect of all this, as there so often is that the writer of grouper work must himself be only an instance of the tendency he describes or advocates, and he can't claim much in the way of personal originating genius. Marx and his writings, for example, for all their vigour and at their best, their clarity and passion, must be merely instances of early Marxism. So the emergence of fresh programmes of action is all a matter of group dynamism. And one of the great effects of that is, and indeed the intentions very often, is to enlarge the relevant community so that the group pool includes many more practitioners and participants than traditionally supposed. Participants very often from different countries or classes or regions. The point of this being to smother the pretensions of the smaller original group, let alone of any individual within it, to have got there first. Now, both the hero worshippers and the groupers are instinctive polarizers. They yield to the tug of the opposite pole only in extremis and like to establish their coherent picture as the conventional wisdom governing all activity. But I'd like to offer an alternative approach, not to supplant the two prevailing ones, which are so fiercely opposed, but to offer a kind of supplementary possibility, a resting place between two extreme interpretations and one which, as often as not, provides a useful approximation to the truth. In one of his recent columns in the TLS, the poet P.J. Kavanagh quoted some words of the Dominican philosopher Herbert McCabe, which I'll read to you. "I should perhaps introduce here my invention of the sesquiguous, which lies somewhere between the ambiguous and the plonking or flat statement. The plonking statement is one-dimensional, clear, unarguable, and unimportant. The ambiguous statement, on the other hand, has two meanings. Ambiguity is the style of the liberal. We need, therefore, a word which has neither two meanings nor one, but one and a half meanings. Sesquiguous, therefore, springs to mind." And I thought we could adopt this thought for the purposes of this debate, using the sesqui, one and a half, as in sesquicentenary, 150th centenary. I thought at first of sesquipod, but that sounded rather too galumphing. So I proposed to coin for a moment the word sesquin, with its rather nice shimmery connotations of sequin and a slightly chainy feeling of sequence. What do I mean by a sesquin? I mean a human achievement that is neither unequivocally singular nor limitlessly plural, one that owes its spark or its driving force or its imaginative leap to a single extraordinary individual, or occasionally stretching it at most to two or three individuals, perhaps in the case of the English Romantics, but which would probably not have happened or wouldn't have happened when it did or how it did or have had such consequences had it not been for other individuals, forerunners, associates, successors, who cleared the ground, clarified the idea, blew the trumpet, made the connection or did the legwork. They couldn't have done it without him, but he couldn't have done it without them. Let me mention boldly and rather haphazardly several candidates for using this this conceit to explain the history of various movements or tendencies. I take, for example, Christianity, Darwinism, Marxism, Thatcherism, the abolition of slavery, the discovery of DNA. They all seem to me, I'm not, of course, pretending these phenomena are in any sense comparable themselves, but the pattern of the way they took hold and became established seems to me to have something of this quality about it. The individual, the outstanding individual, always needs road makers to flatten the ground, prepare the intellectual climate, remove some, but usually not all, the obstacles to understanding the new work. There has to, in fact, remain some considerable barrier for the hero to break down, or he simply would be not a hero but another road maker. John the Baptist spells out his role. He makes the way straight, he spreads the word, he prepares the ground. He's not the Messiah himself, but he's sent to proclaim his coming. Or the roadmaker may proclaim some sort of technical device without which the hero would find it impossible to construct his new platform. Hegel contributes the dialectical process to Marxism. John contributes the idea of baptism and proselytization. Sir Charles Lyell not merely contributed the ideas of gradual geological change, but linked them to what he called a progressive state of existence in the globe, which included both inorganic and organic life. Thus, he flattens the road for Darwin's arrival, both in the sense of making it easier for Darwin's ideas to gain popular acceptance, but also by postulating a general impersonal tendency in the processes of evolutionary change, approach that some historians say may have helped Darwin himself to gain confidence in his crucial insight that natural selection may spontaneously produce order, including highly complex order. Lyell, of course, is also a popularizer because of his geological works published in the 1830s and 40s, had great success and therefore rendered what seems to us with hindsight Darwin's earthquake in 1859 at least, if not less catastrophic for the prevailing belief in divine purpose and creation, at least somewhat less surprising. And of course Lyell was not the only road maker. It was a lucky accident that another of the pioneers of evolutionary thought, Robert Chambers, was also a publisher with his brother William. They were the inventors of Chambers's journal and Chambers's encyclopedia. But Robert Chambers wrote the hugely influential Vestiges of the Natural History of Creation, published in 1844, anonymously. And his role remained more or less hidden until 40 years later, long after his death. So therefore there's a huge amount of groundwork going on, providing a general flattened ground for Darwin to sketch out his paradigm. There are also, of course, codifiers who come along at a later stage, nailing down into place what Thomas Kuhn has taught us to call the new paradigm, enabling the rising generation to practice what becomes, quote, normal science, unquote. Now, it's interesting in the structure of scientific revolutions that Kuhn describes the whole process of replacing one paradigm with another as an extended historical episode, and regrets that he, too, is compelled to use what he calls to employ the unfortunate simplification that tags this episode with a single and somewhat arbitrarily chosen name, e.g. Newton or Franklin, close quote. There's not much talk in the structure of scientific revolutions about the precise role of this or that person or name in the protracted and painful business of switching from one familiar, long-cherished paradigm to another. And oddly enough, you'll find something of the same lack of interest in the personalities if you turn to another influential account of how we come to change our minds about things, and that's on human conduct, the remarkable work of Michael Oateshott, who provides the envoi to each program of the Conversazione. Here, instead of paradigms, we have what Oateshott calls platforms of understanding. We hop clumsily and reluctantly from one such platform to another. We may, in passing, acknowledge the role of someone Oateshott calls rather grimly the theorist, with a capital T, who has surveyed the old platform from some independent eyrie and suggested how to put up the scaffolding for the new one. But Oakeshott, who's not much in favour of theories, says that such a person can't be expected to be loved or honoured. Indeed, he may be regarded as an enemy of the people for having disturbed their old preconceptions with which they had grown so comfortable. But will this picture of an awkward but essentially collective endeavour, in which the exceptional individual stands out only briefly and perhaps arbitrarily, quite do? Is the anti-heroic, groupist account of change, which so often goes with belief in inevitability, whether in science or philosophy or politics or the arts, quite as sophisticated and accurate as it makes out? Is every process of change merely a sort of collective exercise, not unlike that of one of those terrible military exercises of a platoon attempting to cross a river, in which the sergeant barks out instructions for the complicated use of rope ladders and pontoons, and we all get over safely in the end, but you wouldn't think of saying that anyone was the leader in the enterprise. Now, there is, for example, the glaring, embarrassing fact, which seems to me fatal for both the pure, unvarnished collective view and also for the view of inevitability, that the popularizers and codifiers, even if they come along quite a long time after the initial impetus, may quite miss the point, not just in some minor detail, but in the central thrust. And they're missing the point if they're vigorous and effective popularizers, may perpetuate colossal and ruinous misunderstanding for years, if not generations. Engels simplified and vulgarized Marxism. T.H. Huxley mildly and Herbert Spencer hopelessly misunderstood the central, deceptively simple principle of Darwinism, and the horrors of social Darwinism have a lot to answer for eugenics underpinning the Nazi ideology and a good deal else. And then, of course, there is St. Paul. Well, that's a lifetime study. Did he misunderstand the teachings of Jesus or deliberately set out to transform them into something very different? But I'm not here concerned to argue what the true nature of any of these doctrines or purposes really is, even assuming that you could usefully ask such a question. My only purpose is to suggest that if you look coldly at many of these extended historical episodes, to use Kuhn's rather cool phrase, what strikes you is not the waving field of poppies, but how far the tall poppy stands above his or her neighbours, how different his imaginative reach, his forceful grasping of what really matters, and his fearless departure from his forerunners and friends. It's only if you set out with the ex post facto, predetermined objective of tracing the emergence of the new doctrine that you can begin to overlook the towering, crucial role of the central figure, who gave the movement its name, and deservedly so, because at the time it may well have seemed like touch and go. Now, the central figure himself or herself doesn't always get everything right. Darwin has no inkling of genetics. Marx's prophecies are comically adrift of reality. Margaret Thatcher comes a cropper on the poll tax, or was it on Europe? But what they understand in their different ways, they understand with a power and directness that none of their contemporaries can quite match. But this is not in any way to detach them from their historical and intellectual contexts. Carlyle's great man theory is a hyper-rhapsodic misreading of history, which, although at his best Carlyle can establish a context as vividly as any historian that ever wrote, but this overstrained presentation of the great man alone in the end adds a kind of unpleasant and unconvincing turn to his rendering of history. So I offer you the sesquin, the one and a half, the tall poppy, but the essential surrounding poppies, as an extra device for describing how the world very often comes to turn. Not always in that way, but very often. And I think there's a reason for this. In moving from one platform of understanding to another, one way of doing things, one way of looking at the world, one way of approaching the political problems of the day, there is, as often as not, a critical, what I would call clambering moment, in which our footing is no longer secure on the old platform, but we have not as yet got our weight securely transferred to the new platform. We, the broad mass of people, and even the narrower group of people who are concerned and anxious to solve this problem, to make the leap, we are uncertain, we are fearful. Perhaps it might be better to go back for a while. The doctrine of unripe time rears its ugly head. Perhaps the new platform won't take our weight. It's then that we need the single individual who will articulate the new understanding with force and clarity, and who can confront the old doctrine without fear and tear it to pieces and ridicule its supporters. Now, a committee, a group, any form of collective is unsuited for this task. A committee, however enthusiastic, needs to balance its members' interests, express the nuances of their misgivings, take account of their variant readings. That way you never get off the ground floor. What I'm talking of would have been described by a more innocent generation as a matter of leadership before that word fell under a black cloud. So let us now, while giving context and background and society and the long-run historical processes they're due, acknowledge that there are situations in which only a single, clear, powerful, sometimes a rasping voice can see us through, situations in which the answer is a sesquin. And I think even those long-run processes, which we have, I think the broad mass so far of pro-individualists have contentedly accepted as being the background which within which we pursue our limited play for our will, even those are not as indefeasible or uninterrupted as has perhaps been said, that after all globalization, you could well say, was purring along nicely in the decades leading up to 1914. And there's some economic historians have even argued that the world, although the speed of communication was infinitely less, the world was in certain senses more globalized then even than today. But what I'd like to point out here is that globalization was sharply interrupted by war and tariffs and protectionism for a very long period before deregulation and the free movement of capital and goods became the new entrenched wisdom. So even these long-run processes, population is another very good one, since it is, if you go back to the 30s, there was the tremendous worry about depopulation. I went to the opening of the first session of the European Parliament, and all the French delegates, even then, in the 1960s, were talking about France's problem of la natalité, and I simply didn't know what it was because we were so unused to worrying about the birth rate. But we are now beginning, at least in Western Europe, and that is obviously a tendency spreading across the world, beginning to worry about the declining populations in the industrialized world, not here, but elsewhere. That, again, may turn out to be a much more short-run worry. So even these impersonal processes are not quite as plain sailing as they're sometimes represented. I would offer only one final argument, which has been mentioned before, I think, by David Fromkin, to suggest that historical inevitabilities are often, in fact, no more than contingent probabilities, in which the outcome may be significantly variable, and where the variability is a good deal to the ideas and actions of a great man. And it is simply this, that if you study the areas where the great man is wrong, you will often find that he was just as influential in those areas as those in which we continue to regard him as having been right. Influential error, I think, is a very important subject, rather neglected one, and I'm sure a good book could be written on it. I'm not suggesting that the ways in which Marx was wrong about the future of capitalism are directly comparable with the ways in which, say, Darwin was unclear about genetics. But such errors do, as it were, leave stains or signposts on the landscape, suggesting that the great man's legacy is indeed an individual and personal one. And a mistaken theory may have lasting influence and retain explanatory power long after its flaws have been pointed out. So potent and alluring was its initial formulation. The theory of the social contract, for example, doesn't correspond to any remotely probable reality of how human society first came into being, let alone how it later developed. Yet as a useful fiction, it has inspired and continues to inspire a multitude of both of political theory and political practice, ranging from the Constitution of the United States to the work of John Rawls. And talking of useful fictions, Nietzsche's phrase, let us consider for a moment the work of that most fashionable and influential of all modern philosophers. His work continues today to animate or excite all sorts of people, artists, writers, philosophers, politicians, madmen. Yet scholars increasingly make it clear that what excites them is not only what Nietzsche actually wrote with all its perversities and lacunae and contradictions, but also the systematic representation, misrepresentation of that work for motives both devious and muddle-headed. So that the upshot is that most people, certainly most sort of lay people, have come to think of Nietzsche as a grim, Germanic, Wagnerian, anti-Semitic, irrational thinker, when in fact he was a Francophile who placed laughter among the highest of the virtues, who admired the Jews, in some ways at any rate, became disenchanted with Wagner, both as a man and a musician, and was deeply impressed by the progress of the natural sciences. Just as a counterintelligence officer may deliberately insert false information into a message in order to track down the source of a damaging leak, so we may judge the true influence of great men often by the durability of their mistakes. Lurking in the background, finally, of any discussion of inevitability is the ancient philosophical discussion about free will and moral responsibility, which has been touched on. We are told that the causes which predispose any of us, you, me, Napoleon, Tolstoy, to take a particular action in a particular set of circumstances, lie embedded in our past and in the past of our fathers and forefathers, unalterable, set in stone. All actions are thus predetermined, and we have no license to assign moral or any other type of responsibility to a person who chooses to do this rather than that. And accordingly, a person cannot be praised or blamed for his actions. This daunting argument continues to daunt, perhaps, according to my philosopher friends, perhaps the majority of philosophers, even today, would describe themselves as determinists in one sense or another. So I certainly wouldn't dare to confront it head on. But in concluding here today, I'd only venture to point out, as Arthur Schlesinger did, that determinism only operates exclusively by hindsight. On the morning of the Derby, the determinist cannot tell you how the race will go, nor can he tell you in advance that Wellington will win the Battle of Waterloo because Blücher will get there just in time. All he can say after the event is that it could not have turned out other than it did because the causes were as they were. The favourite ran faster than the rest of the field. Blücher did arrive in time. But put like that, the determinist doesn't really seem to be saying very much, since he has produced an argument which has a strong look of circularity about it, that he defines causes as those things which produce events, or every event must have a cause. So it is impossible to imagine a causeless event, but that is a function of language, of the use of the idea of cause to define anything that precedes an event, whether it be a muscular twitch, the fall of the pebble or the snowflake, or an impulse in the mind of God. If there were things that produced events that were not to count as causes, then determinism could not be universally true. So the more you brood on this thesis and even accept that the philosophers may happily play with it until the end of time, since they have been playing with it since the beginning of philosophy, the stuffing in the idea of historical inevitability does begin to leak a little. If we use cause in a more robust, practical sense, we shall feel inclined to say that one happening had a multitude of causes, while another was a pure accident. We shall begin to see some events as overdetermined, others as the nearest run thing you ever saw in your life, as the Duke of Wellington said of the Battle of Waterloo. And as you will recall, he added, "By God, I don't think we would have done if I had not been there." no believer in inevitability or the collective there. And if we look at the course of events in that high discriminating light, I think we shall begin to take it for granted that human agency is neither a delusion nor a trivial matter. We may not be quite the master of our fate or the captain of our soul, but we can at least claim to be the first lieutenant. Thank you very much.
British political philosopher and constitutional commentator Ferdinand Mount. This is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. You're listening to an excerpt from the annual Boston, Melbourne, Oxford Conversazioni on Culture and Society, held last fall at Boston University. We just heard from Ferdinand Mount, whose lecture was entitled When Two or More Are Gathered Together, Small Groups and Great Movements. Now, reacting to Mr. Mount's assertions, his university professor and professor of journalism at the College of Communication, Lance Morrow. A writer and essayist with Time magazine for 32 years, Professor Morrow has written more than 150 cover stories for Time, including the Person of the Year on 7 occasions. He also holds an appointment as an adjunct professor of English in the College of Arts and Sciences. Professor Lance Morrow.
I hadn't an opportunity to read Mr. Mount's wonderful paper in advance, so I slightly mistrust rapid response. I think of the incredibly irrational notes that Harry Truman used to write and then put into a desk drawer, thank God, because he would write things like let's blow up the Russians tomorrow or something like that. I have no impulse to try and blow up Mr. Mount. I think that in this whole all day I have been sort of fighting with myself as to between a level of the larger, and we're dealing with very large terms here, and free will and determinism and inevitabilities and so on, and a plane of common sense on which, and not that there isn't common sense in these larger things, but a plane of that is more pedestrian in its approach. And so if you'll permit me, I'm going to be rather pedestrian for a few minutes. I'd like to recall to you a scene from Orson Welles' movie Citizen Kane, in which Mr. Bernstein, who for a long time was Charles Foster Kane's business manager, is being interviewed by the March of Time type documentary maker. Mr. Bernstein, they're talking about Kane's fortune. And Mr. Bernstein says, well, there's no trick to making a lot of money if all you want to do is make a lot of money. And I have thought of this over the years as Bernstein's law, because I can apply it to politicians, for example, and many politicians whom I've watched over a period of time who have become presidents and so on. And there was no trick to their doing it, in a sense, I'm exaggerating, no trick to their doing it if all you want to do is do that. Indeed, to say something rather brutal, there's no trick to blowing up the World Trade Center if all you want to do is blow up the World Trade Center. What I'm getting at is it applies to politicians, it applies to corporate executives, or it applies to terrorists, which is that if you are willing to focus, if you are one of those people who is willing to focus upon certain things that are necessary to be done in order to accomplish certain tasks, you may find yourself in changing, becoming president or accomplishing great change. Bill Clinton, as we all know, was still is a kind of political genius who for years was doing the things necessary that I wouldn't dream of spending doing what a politician has to do in order to become a successful politician, which spend about 300 to 325 nights a week doing all sorts of unpleasant things like meeting and greeting and fundraising and politicking and doing some reprehensible things and so on. So I'm making a slightly common sense point that that the success in these, even world-changing success in this, has a lot to do with simply with focus, with the concentration of the people who are doing it. I'm leaving aside, Mr. Mount was talking, began with Wordsworth and Coleridge, and was dealing on the level of genius. And as I say, I'm speaking of a much more pedestrian and day-to-day sort of thing. An element that I would just inject here, because I think it's so important, and I'm not certain. I missed, unfortunately, one of the sessions this afternoon, but I'm not sure that this matter has been given sufficient attention. There's a wonderful line of Proudhon, which I repeat to myself and sometimes use in writing about any particularly shocking, unexpected event. And the line is, "The fecundity of the unexpected far exceeds the prudence of statesmen." And I would argue that the fecundity of the unexpected far exceeds also the imaginations of and the expectations of most intellectuals. The fecundity of the unexpected, the element of sheer surprise, the element of world-changing surprise, is extremely important, and in my mind raises the a question about the metaphors that we use to describe what we're up to in all of this. Platforms. Mr. Mount has spoken of the platforms and moving from one platform to another. There's a fascinating relationship between, which is an obvious one and much commented upon, between the state of scientific knowledge at any particular time and the metaphors used in more general discourse, the Newtonian vocabularies. The vocabularies arising out of steam and the pressure and so on, the nuclear vocabularies, fallout and that kind of thing. I'm not sure platforms, I wonder how useful platforms are, and I tend toward more toward the, I'm particularly beguiled by some of the things beyond chaos theory, like strings and suds, and I suppose sesquins comes into this area. Mr. Mount's intuition to, I believe that Professor Pipes this morning, when he gave his very brief summary of the matter, I think I agreed entirely with what he was saying, and I take it that Mr. Mount, in the one and a half solution, is coming into the same territory. In other words, that as between inevitability and the individual, there is a relationship that it is simultaneous, and that both are obviously going on. I think that, if I may just offer one further thought, it seems to me that inevitability, however, is something that can only be discussed in retrospect. I don't see how it's possible to. This has been mentioned in various ways. I think that inevitability is only seaworthy if it is as a retrospective proposition. One last thought: the role of global communications in the way that history happens, enacts itself, it becomes possible, seems to me to be one that we ought to pay a good deal of attention to, the ways in which the democratization of information and the globalization of information has have changed. How does that affect the relation between leaders and followers? The democratization of information, it seems to me, and the availability of the technology seems to me extremely important. I'm afraid that I haven't dealt a great deal with Mr. Mount's speech, mainly because it seemed to me so perfectly stated that I could hardly add to it. But anyway, those are a few thoughts that that have occurred to me on the subject.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. You're listening to excerpts from the Boston, Melbourne, Oxford Conversazione. And as the name implies, it is a conversation, typified by questions and statements from a participating audience. Here now are those questions, with responses from Ferdinand Mount and Lance Morrow.
Yeah, I'd like to quibble with this notion that seems to be quite popular in the room, that determinism is no ex-ante content and only exposed content, and is therefore entirely useless. Of course, if we phrase it in the way Mr. Mount did, he must be right. If I can say nothing about the likely winner of the Derby in the morning, and I make it seem it's inevitable in the afternoon, that doesn't take me very far. But I think that rests on a misunderstanding on what we mean by making predictions and adding elements of determination. What useful determinism does is make probabilistic statements based on conditions. If I say to you that horse A is more likely to win on the basis of his weight and his training or something like that, I may not be right all the time, but I will be right part of the time. And that strikes me as a non-trivial addition to human knowledge. Let me phrase it in terms of the other analogy you used, the poppies and the field. If you tell me something about the quality of the soil, I will certainly not be able to tell you which poppy will stand taller and look prettier, but I can be pretty damn sure that I can tell you something about the average quality of the poppies, and which, when applied to large numbers of people or societies at large, is actually, again, not a trivial addition to what we know about that society. Which takes me to my last point, which has to do with Marx. Claudia tried to rehabilitate Tolstoy. Let me try to do the same thing with Marx for 1 second. There's a passage in Marx's manuscripts of 1844, which is what we all quote nowadays, which says that, of course, men do make their history, but they make it in given circumstances. Poppies do reach a certain height, but in a given kind of soil. Maybe in that sense, Marx was right, after all.
I wouldn't disagree with a single word of that, except that I think the use of the word determinism isn't very helpful to describe all these incredibly useful activities of probabilistic forecasting, soil analysis. I think it's just simply this word determinism, which then gets allied with philosophical determinism, which is, as I said, an argument too tough for me to take on, to produce possibly a kind of straw man version of determinism, which isn't really what people are talking about. But I just think we'd be happier if we didn't use the word and talk about probabilistic or serious chances. The fact that if you took your view of what I said to extremes, I mean, there would be no racing pages because it wouldn't be worth anybody trying to predict the winner of the Derby. Of course, there are strong probabilities, and there are very strong probabilities. There are odds-on horses, but even odds-on horses sometimes don't come unstuck.
Could I ask you to go one further from what you just said about sesquins and talk about great eras in history, and can we explain those in any way, thinking of 5th century Greece or Elizabethan England?
I think those are completely unpredictable combinations of circumstances which probably arise from, again, close-run things which enable the society to flourish independently for long enough. But on the other hand, you wouldn't even it's quite often hard to make any kind of identification between political stability and security and the flourishing of a civilization.
Several people today have spoken of events having causes. But I wonder whether is that really the case? I mean, let's take the First World War, that was an event. I mean, effects have causes, but do events really have causes?
Effects is simply saying that which is produced by a cause, whether it's a fall of gravel or one falling over on the gravel. I mean, a war is something rather different, and it is such a complex of circumstances, both long run rival ambitions of the contending parties, and short run the fact that Gavrilo Princip got the Archduke on the second round when he came back the back way or up the alley or whatever it was. I couldn't agree more. To lump all that together under a cause-event link immediately sets you off on the wrong track in trying to establish how things happen.
But would you say that the American Civil War had no cause, or I don't quite.
I guess the point of it is that if you admit that there are such things as events, then you also admit that there's such a thing as contingency and freedom.
You've been listening to a lecture by political philosopher and author Ferdinand Mount, and reaction from University Professor Lance Morrow from last fall's Boston Melbourne Oxford Conversazioni on responsibility and historical inevitability. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15 and includes shipping and handling. To learn more about Boston University's World of Ideas, visit our website at buwi.org. Tonight's program was produced by Vince Fairchild, with help from Tina Toby, Mike Toda, and John Hoder. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for being with us.